Kevin, thank you for doing this and taking the time in your busy schedule to meet with us and cover some of these points. I'd like to start by you, if you can give us a brief description of what the GDPR stands for and what it is, like in a nutshell, and who's affected by it.
Sure, and thank you for asking me to participate. I'm really happy to help educate the community around GDPR. So GDPR is short for General Data Protection Regulation. And basically what it does is it replaces the current 1995 EU data protection directives and has basically provided a completely new framework to the way we are to collect, process, and protect the personal data of citizens and residents from the European Union, which also include, until further notice, the UK. And the EU GDPR will be directly applicable from May 25th, 2018. So that's just, when you think about it, it's less than 2 months from now.
Yes. I know that there's a lot of talk about it. I mean, every single social media feed I go on, everybody's talking about GDPR. It seems everybody in a frantic mode about it and mm-hmm. a lot of negative views on it. But I think that there could be some positive that comes out of it that kind of ensures a better practice in using and using personal data. Can you, you know, give us an idea of how you see it yourself as a positive practice?
Yeah, there's a lot of positive things about GDPR, which I think people generally, to your point, Rachel, they don't focus on that. They only focus on like a negative. But there's actually quite a lot of positive things that will come about with GDPR. And the first thing is it's going to standardize the personal data definitions, guidelines, and regulations across the 28 member European Union countries, including the UK. You know, right now, every European Union country kind of has their own version or iteration of data privacy rules. And what GDPR does is really standardizes it across the region, which makes it lots less confusing and expensive to administrate regulations around data privacy per country versus regulating it throughout the region. Now, that means also that countries can make their data privacy rules a little bit stricter, but at least you know with GDPR, that's the baseline or standard for data privacy protection for the individual. I think the other good thing is, you know, the United States, unfortunately, has probably one of the worst data privacy lack of regulations in place, and that's the reason why a lot of American companies get hacked a lot, or there's a lot of identity fraud and a lot of data hacking going on. I think, you know, GDPR will pressure the U.S. to really improve their data privacy standards and regulations to match, you know, the rigor that's taken around data privacy around the world. Another good thing is, a lot of current practices in our industry are really kind of outdated in terms of the data that we use, the membership registration list that we use, the way we allow our information to get reused covertly or not through marketing organizations, the selling of registration lists, et cetera, et cetera. So what GDPR is going to do is clean that all up, make it much more difficult for companies to sell our information, as well as, force people to be a lot more consistent and a lot more regulatory around getting consent, documentation of that consent, and also the ability to delete anybody's private information, personal information upon request. So a lot of these things are good things, in my opinion, that really will help to kind of clean up some really bad practices that currently exist in our industry.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. Next question I have, how do you think, I know in international conferences, I've been worked with, many of them in the past years. When a conference travels from country to country, there is that sort of a trade of lists from one host to another in order to help promote that conference. How is that affected by that?
So that's affected because you can't do blanket consents anymore. So anytime you have any kind of new conference or event, you have to have consent from all of the people being sent invitations to register, and you have to have consent from all of the people who actually register. So a lot of that has to do with the language and descriptions used in the consent form. And so that's, you know, going to have to be very, and according to GDPR, you have to make it in very easy to understand, concise language. You can't bury it in a whole page full of legalese information, which people generally tend to not to read. It's got to be very easy to understand. It's got to be simple to understand. And most importantly, it has to have an exit or a deletion, a right for deletion path. And description built into the consent form. So those things are all going to be mandatory now.
Mm-hmm.
And so regardless of what country you're in, if you've got a European Union citizen or resident attending, then GDPR applies to that convention,
okay,
that exhibition, that meeting or event.
Okay. And how about members of associations? And aren't they by default giving consent by becoming member to an association that they would, you know, normally get that communications from that association? Does the association need to resend and re-engage them to give a specific complicit consent?
Not necessarily. Well, let me take that back. So yes, a lot of it is going to be dependent upon when you renew your membership in that association, or if you're joining for the first time. The original consent form needs to contain how their information is being used, you know, which suppliers have access to this information, and how are they going to be using that information. And so a lot of that has to be easy to understand, specific, and built into any kind of registration renewal or any kind of new registration.
And does it the same thing for delegates? I'm assuming, you know, if they attended in the past, they need to also be asked again to consent?
Yes. You have to not only ask for the consent, you have to document that they gave you the consent and when and where they gave you that consent. So if you're asking them to tick a box or give an electronic consent, that's great because that's already automatically captured. The mm-hmm. challenge is going to be documenting the consent from, let's say, a fax form or a verbal agreement or something like that, because that then becomes a manual entry,
yeah,
and you have to have that documented as well.
It's like when you're at a trade show and somebody hands you their business card. Is that considered consent?
Well, it is, but just to make sure, you know, you need to make sure that, you know, like I personally don't give business cards anymore. I usually ask to link in with them electronically.
Mm-hmm.
Then that kind of covers, you know, my access and utilization of their personal data. Where somebody could get into trouble is if you give a business card or you give them your business information and all of a sudden they're on a marketing communication list that they didn't agree to, but the only reason why they're on, now granted they're going to have to prove that it came from your business card exchange, but nevertheless, you see where I'm going with
yeah.
this, right? That's the whole purpose of GDPR, is to make sure that just because I gave you my business card doesn't mean that you have the right to add me to a marketing distribution list, because I did not give you consent to do that.
I see. Okay. And when it comes to third-party partners, because, you know,
yes,
you know, with registration companies, housing and all that stuff, you know, how can an association or meeting planner ensures that those partners are also compliant and abiding by the rules that affects the organization as well?
Sure. So that has to be done by consent, you know, agreement, either riders or addendums to existing service level agreements or scope of work documents or a separate attachment of GDPR compliance. And that really needs to be dealt with immediately, because if you're depending on these third parties, which according to GDPR are classified as processors, right, you should have an agreement with all of your processing partners that they will adhere to GDPR and they will, you know, abide by a lot of the regulations that are defined under GDPR. And failure to do so will result in XYZ. You know, you pay 100% of any kind of fines that are assessed, or we pay 50, you pay 50%, or, you know, all those things need to be specified before May 25th, or you run the chance of something happening and getting fined, and then it'll be a real legal mess as to who's really responsible for defending and paying out any kind of fine or assessments that are made by the EU.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, if somebody, you know, in some cases, you have lists of potential, let's say, participants, delegates, or members, but you don't really track anything about where they are geographically. So you could have a whole list, and you know that there's a percentage of them are in Europe, but you don't know for sure because you're not, you don't have the country, or you don't have that specific information on them. Right. How can you go about you know, ensuring that you're GDPR compliant? Do you, you know, again, send it across the board for everybody?
Yeah. So what I've seen happening for companies that are getting GDPR ready in the US as well as other parts of the world is they're all accepting one standard around personal data protection. And GDPR is the most, how should I say it? It's probably the best defined personal data protection standards that there is. So what I see a lot of companies doing is rather than have separate processing paths, one for Americans and one for EU and UK citizens, is they basically have gone to the stricter standard. So they've all adopted the GDPR standards and regulations as the new consent and the new forms that they're putting out there. Does that make sense? So in other words, instead of creating separate processing paths, they just accepted the strictest processing path, because in that way, they're almost guaranteed that they're not going to run afoul of GDPR.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't that pose a risk, though, for, you know, losing a big chunk of your database?
Yeah, it actually, yes and no, because again, depending on the information you're collecting and why you're collecting it, if that's declared upfront, very transparently and easy to understand language, and you also provide a list of your processing partners, processor partners, mm-hmm. those things are all advised in advance and they consent to it, then you still can collect that information as long as you're very transparent about how you're using it, why you're using it, and who has access to it.
Mm-hmm. But like, if I give an example, you know, you have a database of 20,000 people and you already have a very low open rate on it, and you want to do the campaign to get them to consent to receive information from you. Already, if you're getting 20% of that, you're getting already a smaller portion who's engaging with you. And after that, you're going to have to drop that 80% because they didn't consent, they didn't respond, they didn't do anything with that communication.
Yeah. So what I would say to that is
That's scary for any organization.
You know what? I totally understand that. But you have to think of it this way: is it kind of levels the playing field. So it's not just you, but it's everybody else who has those kind of legacy lists that they're all going to have to conform to the new standards. And what I would say about that, being very honest about this, is a lot of those lists are very outdated. So yeah, you may have 20,000 people on that list, but the response rate is pretty dismal from my understanding, right? The reason why it's dismal is because a lot of that information on those lists is already outdated. People have moved on, people have changed, people are no longer interested. So it's not a numbers, it's not a quantity game, it becomes a quality game. So by GDPR, what you're doing is you're improving the quality of these lists, right? And because you're going to have to keep it current. And I would say it increases the engagement level to people that are truly interested in engaging, and yes, not just this mass blanketing of marketing information that, you know, 80% is really not interested in. I mean, really, that doesn't help anybody.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so how do you think, you know, they're going to be able to enforce this in countries like the US or Canada, like outside of the EU? How does it come to light?
Yeah, so the way you get people to comply is obviously with the fines and the assessments that are going to be made against companies or individuals that violate GDPR. And, you know, the one thing I will say is, you know, in the European Union is not shy about going after any company and assessing them a fine. And they've been very successful in collecting those fines from very large American tech companies and other European companies that are in violation of existing European Union laws, not just GDPR, but, you know, antitrust laws and anti-competition laws and things like that. So GDPR is no different. It's another EU initiative that's regulatory in nature, and they are very good and very thorough and very consistent in prosecuting those who fall outside of adherence to the regulations. So the history that they've shown is they're not shy and they're not afraid to go after any company that violates the regulations set forth by the European Union.
Okay, so there's no geographical limitation to how far they can go?
No, and when you think about it, we live in a global economy, right? Mm-hmm. So there are many things that they could do for lack of compliance. You know, they could do company boycott. I mean, there's so many things that they could do if they're not getting the results or people aren't taking them seriously. But I have to say, just going by past history of behavior and success ratio of fines and assessments, the EU has been extremely successful in collecting fines around assessments they've made against companies that violate European regulations.
Okay. So the next question is, you know, we were talking about the different communications for email marketing and such, and I'm curious to know, how does it apply to social media campaigns and marketing?
So social media is also, I think right now that you see what's happening with the attention paid to Cambridge Analytica and Facebook. So that's a perfect example of why GDPR is important. You know, that's unauthorized access and utilization of private information. So what you see right now is social media companies, especially those headquartered in the U.S., have got to change their forms and their consent. I wouldn't be surprised if they send out a re-consent form to opt in to using social media, things like that. But they also have to change fundamentally some of the ways that they collect and use information, personal information, from all of their subscribers. I think the biggest change, though, is going to come around marketing firms and marketing utilization of personal data. Without consent from the individual, they will no longer be allowed to do that. What does that mean? That means that a lot of companies today that are in the revenue generation model of reselling people's personal information via lists, and they sell those lists to companies who want to create marketing campaigns, that whole practice is going to have to change significantly in order to remain legal under GDPR. So I think what you're going to see is a lot of time and motion put into by marketing firms who basically are in the business of reselling personal information.
Mm-hmm. The different angle, though, for working with social media when you're doing social media campaigns and you're putting out a content or you're connecting with people, whether on Twitter, Facebook, or LinkedIn, Instagram, whatever, the direct messages that you have with them there, does that even fall under the GDPR rules that it has to be also compliant?
Yes and no. I think that is still kind of being evaluated on a grander scale, if you will. But you know, GDPR is really focused around corporations and their utilization of personal information for purposes other than what they are meant to be doing. So to the degree that social media falls under that, you know, because social media is basically a social personal opt-in, mm-hmm. More personal in nature than business related. Although, you know, one can say that, again, you know, falling under the marketing purposes of your personal information, is that legal or not? I think, you know, a lot of that still is, I wouldn't be surprised if that comes up sooner than later in some of these earlier deliberations of legitimacy under GDPR.
Okay. So if an organization now is like, you know, they're all scrambling now to get compliant and Although it's old news for some, but for some,
it is for me.
How long have you known?
I've known since the EU first came out with this whole GDPR new standards. And when I heard about that from some technology friends of mine, I was immediately thought about our industry. I thought, oh, good grief. This is going to be very time consuming and costly to change a lot of processes and forms and things that we currently do and we take for granted, you know, even down to the point of, you know, encrypting data and password protecting data and allowing that data access to like non-employees or, you know, part-time workers or things like that. It has just such a big ramification in our industry. So I started trying to educate the industry well over a year ago. Mm-hmm. And frankly, nobody was really interested, or people were just in denial by saying, you know, I don't see how this applies to me. You know, I'm just hosting an event. And they just weren't making that connection of, yeah, but you deal with people's personal information with your conferences and events and your meetings all the time. So this does apply to you, right? Mm-hmm. And I always knew, Rachel, that, you know, as the closer we got to May 25th, the more people would wake up and realize, oh my goodness, this does apply to me. Right.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what's happening right now. People are scrambling when they could have tackled this over a year ago and they wouldn't be scrambling now. Right. And recent survey that my company just did, our partner, our friendly collaborator in the UK, Events Force, also did a similar survey, shows that 13% of companies that were surveyed have done nothing towards GDPR readiness. And here we are in April and they have done nothing.
Wow. Do you think they will give an extension? I mean, I know for CASEL, for the Canadian anti-spam law, at some point they gave a grace period of a year to get compliant.
So what I've read about that is if you can demonstrate that you're taking the right steps, but it's just taking time to get your house in order to be GDPR compliant, they'll probably cut you some slack. But if you cannot demonstrate that you've done anything towards recognition and at compliance towards GDPR, then you are a prime frontline target for some kind of assessment. And the assessment is very hefty. You know, it's 20 million euro, which is about 23 million USD.
That's what puts a lot of organization into bankruptcy.
Yeah, well, yes, it will. And that's why, you know, it's not insignificant. You know, people need to really take this seriously, especially if they're a multinational company or association.
Mm-hmm. So where do they start? Like what does it take and who does it take to get this started from a like internal or getting help externally? Like what's the place to start?
So I would say they should definitely start internally, right? Ask internally who is aware of and is working on GDPR compliance for our company or our association. It starts there. If there's nobody, then you need to propose that they get somebody, right? Or somebody take ownership of this, right? Or mm-hmm. if they don't want to take ownership of it, you hire consultancies like mine, you know, to come in and help, you know, kind of get you GDPR ready. You know, we can put you through a checklist or an assessment and just do like a quick gap analysis to show, oh, you really need to focus on this immediately, blah, blah, blah. So there's outside support you can get, but in order to get that, you really need to understand what you're doing internally today. And frankly, you're running out of time. So right now, if I were just getting started, I'd be somewhat in a panic mode, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I would be having those internal conversations and then quickly engaging externally if nothing has been done or things are moving too slow. Right. The other thing I would do is I would absolutely conduct a data and process audit, and I would identify all gaps of suppliers and partners that currently collect personal data, how they're using it, why they're using it, when they delete it. And I would then work on a service level agreement or a scope of work agreement or a rider or an attachment or an addendum about GDPR. Outlining, you know, the roles and responsibilities and the liability, who's going to own the liability if there's a fine assessed. So I would definitely look externally to see who's touching the data, who's collecting it, why are they collecting it. I was talking to this one woman who did a tops to bottom review, And she said, I won't lie to you, Kevin. She said it was very painful, but it was so educational for us because our program is kind of mature and we were doing things that are outdated, unnecessary. We had suppliers touching data that they had no reason to touch the data. We're collecting data that we really don't need. So it really helped us to really clean up our process and our house and our supplier engagements and partner engagements and all of those things. So yes, you know, it is tedious, but in order to kind of figure out what you need to do next, you need to understand what you're doing today. So I think it's very important to conduct a data and a process audit. And also don't be afraid to engage all of your partners as well who are supporting you in your process and your data collection.
Mm-hmm. And the service level agreement that you're mentioning, that requires an intervention of a lawyer or some legal entity to be able to draft something that's going to be solid enough to protect any organization.
Yes, highly recommended. Almost every organization has some legal counsel, internal or external, that they can tap into. I think that there are also GDPR knowledgeable legal lawyers and law firms that you can contact if you really need that. But for the most part, your general counsel can kind of come up with protectionist language to kind of ensure, you know, the scope of GDPR compliance and the liability scope of your partners.
Okay. And from an internally, like the resource internally that you mentioned, is there any specific role that person that would be ideal to appoint to kind of take ownership of this process?
Yeah. So, you know, GDPR, depending on the industry that you're in, recommends that you have a data protection officer, but not every business or group or association requires that. So what I would suggest, though, is most companies have a chief technology officer or a chief information officer. Or the whole purpose of a DPO or data protection officer is to get decisions and maintenance and compliance around GDPR, personal data handling and information, at an executive level. So in other words, taking it away from a lower level IT person and really putting it into the attention span an orbit of a senior C-suite executive or a senior executive, right? So I would start somewhere there, you know, whoever's overseeing, you know, your information, your chief information officer, your chief technology officer, also your chief legal counsel. You know, I would get all of them involved and at least create a working task force to ensure that, you know, the company is compliant with regards to GDPR, because remember, it's not just meetings and events or corporate travel. It's also other areas of the company, including sales and marketing. So the other thing too is what I found is there's already an existing GDPR readiness council that a lot of companies have formulated on an enterprise level. And generally, I hate to say this, but meetings and events and travel get forgotten, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you haven't done this already, you really need to do this sooner than later. You need to raise your hand and you need to put yourself on that council or at least be advised or informed of what they're doing so that you can comply in your specific area of responsibility. So in other words, don't wait for them to invite you. Raise your hand and say, I insist that I be included because my area touches personal data information every day.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And yeah, we could unwittingly compromise the company if we're not informed and we're not part of the conversation.
Okay. Are you aware of, you know, any associations, PCMA or specific groups like the ICA, for example, are they doing or helping their members in a way in providing some guidelines or set ways that they can do that for their conferences or their associations?
Yeah, I've heard of a lot of informal activities that the associations are doing. I don't recall seeing anything formalized yet, but I know that as part of, you know, membership value, you know, for an association, they should be leading at least a think tank or discussion or, you know, putting together a checklist for their members, you know, that type of thing. So I would definitely, if they're not doing that, I would encourage them to do that. But there are a lot of resources out there that kind of help people, you know, kind of get GDPR ready. You know, if you go on the web and you type in GDPR for meetings and events and stuff, you'll see a whole bunch of resources and white papers. You know, I know I've written several things. I've had several interviews and did a couple of webinars on GDPR, and I have a couple more coming up. So the information is out there. Mm-hmm. A lot more information than what was available even a year ago or 8 months ago. So if your association is not being proactive, I would say don't wait for them. Just go out and do the research and find out what you need to do to get ready, because you are running out of time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know that Dalia Al-Ghazal, she did on her website, empowerment.events, a whole resource for all the events.
Yes.
And anything, any white paper, any study, any webinar, anything
yes.
touched on GDPR, so they kind of centralize them in one place too.
Yes. Dalia has been not only a great friend, but a true ally. When I first informed her about GDPR, she was shocked and she was horrified that nobody was taking it seriously. So she's been very helpful in helping me to kind of spread the word and get people to really start to take notice of this and be serious about it. And I think that her website is extremely valuable, and I think people can find all the information that they need around GDPR right very easily from that website. So I would mm-hmm. highly encourage people to use that resource.
Yeah, we'll include a link in our blog for that one. And that's exactly how we met, Kevin. It was Dalia who referred you. So great. Any last advice, tips, you know, recommendation that you can give?
Yeah, so I would say do not procrastinate anymore. You know, there's an ancient Chinese philosopher, Lao Tzu, who said the journey of 1,000 miles starts with the first step. And I would just say in closing that, you know, your first step, if you haven't taken it already, you're really running out of runway. So don't just step into it, run into it, and try to get this in motion as soon as you can.
All right. Thank you so much, Kevin, for your time. And I look forward to see how this is going to unfold with everybody. And we're excited to share this insight with our community.
Yeah, you're very welcome.